happy-go-lucky me. Yeah, I can smile when I ain't got no money. Happy-go-lucky me. It may sound silly, but I don't care. I got the moonlight, I got the sun, I've got the stars above. Me and my filly, well, we both share. It's happy go happy, happy go lucky love. Well, life is sweet, whoa, sweet as honey. Happy go lucky me. I've got the stars above. Me and my filly, well, we both share. It's happy go happy, happy go lucky love. Well, life is sweet, whoa, yeah, sweet as honey. Happy go lucky me. Happy go lucky me.
What's happening, everybody? This is Blaine, and we are back with another episode of Grindhouse Messiah with both myself and Justin. Hey, Justin, how's it going, man?
It's going pretty good there, buddy. You know, same shit, different day. That's really about it with me.
Word.
What are we here to talk about today, Blaine?
Today, we have a very special guest we're going to get to in just a minute, but we're going to be talking about absolute cult figure, the Pope of Trash, the Prince of Puke, John Waters, who, you know, is always been a huge influence on cult cinema. And to be honest, I am really excited to be covering something besides horror movies after October, man. I don't know about you guys, but I am a little burned out and ready to kind of get on to something else.
So why don't I just let you go ahead and introduce yourself? Because, you know, I don't know much more than that.
yeah, that works for me. So oh, should I be doing that now? Okay.
Yeah, sounds good.
My name is Adriana Gober. I am a writer and editor for the website Cinepunks, which is a film and music criticism podcast network and website. And totally lost my train of thought.
That sounds
yeah,
so formal, though.
That's how I roll. But
that's awesome. I'm glad you can make it sound way better than Liam could. You know, we talk about Liam here on this podcast every once in a while. He's kind of like the bane of my existence. But
hey, Liam is a nice man. Let's go easy on Liam.
Oh, as he's long as people. He's actually riding high. We'll reference why shortly. But so what do you write for Synapse? You edit for Synapse, and what else do you do?
I write and edit for Cinepunks.
Cinepunks. That Synapse is not that site. That's the site I write for.
Yes, although I do sometimes contribute to the 2 cents column on Synapse, but Cinepunks is really the primary website that I write for. And, of course, Liam is one of the co-creators of Cinepunks.
Indeed he is. And besides, you know, that, what else do you do with yourself and, you know, besides write for Cinepunks?
Well, I'm a musician, so... I'm between bands right now, but
I'm between bands. That should be a podcast. Between bands.
Yeah. We only interview musicians who are doing nothing.
which is like a perfect time to actually catch somebody.
Yeah.
Ain't got shit going. Let's talk. Let's talk about it.
Oh, that's great. And what kind of music have you, you know, performed in the past? What kind of styles are you really mostly into?
Oh, I've been all over the place. I was in a jazz funk fusion band. I was in, like, a psych garage rock band. I was in marching band in high school.
That's awesome.
And, yeah, I mean, kind of. But right now I'm trying to get this sort of synth wave industrial sort of project off the ground. Hopefully that works out, because that's pretty different from the sort of music I've played in the past, and I'm just kind of tired of not playing out.
Okay.
So I'm eager to start playing again.
Very, very cool. I don't know if you know this about me, because you don't know as much about me either, but I actually got more into writing and stuff through music, and film kind of came after for me. I booked concerts from the time I was like 14 through, I don't know, when I had kids is when I kind of fell from doing it. But, you know, sometimes often, sometimes not often. But that said, I kind of started writing about music just because I still wanted to get free shit when I didn't have time to put concerts together anymore. So that's really it. So well, music is big for me, too.
I kind of have a similar background in that music was really my life, and somehow I wound up writing about film. I mean, I like movies too, but I really like music is my primary interest.
Okay, awesome. Well, that's exciting to have somebody who can also talk about music, because I actually think one of the things I really like about a lot of the John Waters stuff that I've kind of been immersing myself in is I think the soundtracks are pretty fantastic.
Oh, totally. They're perfectly curated, because he's like an old 50s and 60s rock and roll R&B guy. And and you hear a lot of that in his films.
Awesome. Well, thanks for the brief introduction. And even though Blaine and I can't seem to get our shit together tonight, sounds like your head screwed on nice and tight, which is good, because we're going to need you to keep us on track, I think.
Well, I'll try my best.
Awesome.
It's all on your shoulders.
Every single bit of this podcast, the success rides on your shoulders, Adriana. So. All right. I don't really mean that. Well, I hope I don't. So before we go on to actually delve into John Waters, and I'm going to kind of let you do a lot of the background on him, because you seem to be our expert. I do want to quick talk about our sponsor, who's been sponsoring us now for a few episodes at least. I guess it's been a couple months now. Vinegar Syndrome, who you are actually a really big fan of. Are you not, Adriana?
Yeah, I love Vinegar Syndrome. They're hands down my favorite boutique Blu-ray and DVD label going right now.
Awesome.
You know, I have a lot of love for Arrow, and I definitely have a lot of love for Criterion, because they were my entry point in this very niche market. They started the disease in me. But Vinegar Syndrome, I think they are doing something that no other label is really doing, and their releases focus on very obscure exploitation and sort of I guess pornographic films that don't really get a lot of love and attention in terms of release and restoration. So, and the guys there, it's a really small, tight knit group of people, and they really care about what they're doing, and they put a lot of care and skill into what they do. And I really appreciate that.
It's awesome to have, you know, somebody who's a big fan of theirs, on, because we obviously really appreciate them. Blaine is really, really into what he likes to call old man porn, although we're not supposed to talk about porn in public anymore, are we, Blaine?
Yes, because of this whole thing, my mother has asked me to quit discussing pornography in public and on shows, but no, as I've said on every episode, I love Vinegar Syndrome. They seem to pick fucking movies right out of my head, things that I just either I saw a long time ago and I haven't been able to kind of revisit, or things that I've always wanted to see. It's like 2 months later, I'm getting the Blu-ray in the mail, and I'm super excited about it. Coming up, they've got some actually really rad stuff. They've got Liquid Sky, which is dropping here shortly. They've got their big Black Friday sale, where just about everything goes about 50% off. And then also, they recently released Throat 12 years later, which I just watched, and it is an amazing kind of like revisionist look at the pornographic film Throat from about 4 or 5 years before this release, or excuse me, 12 years before this release. So it kind of revisits pornography and kind of views that same material through a different lens, and it's really a spectacular kind of way of kind of approaching it almost from a side that's feels a little academic, but still is like a good porno, but also a good film. It just kind of brings it all. So, yeah, no, these guys, we love you. You know, shout out to James over there. And, yeah, hopefully soon we're going to be covering everything we got in October, the fucking amazing Demon Wind, as well as a bunch of Roberta. What's the last name?
Finlay.
Yeah, so we got a bunch of cool
shit.
Yeah,
there's a whole bunch of Roberta Finlay in the October package. So, yeah, I'm excited to dive into her movie. It's probably the next week or so. So then when we talk again next, we'll have a lot to say about those, I'm sure. But, Adriana, thanks so much for being with us. And I'm super excited to have somebody on who can teach me about John Waters, because I'm going to be honest with you. I don't know a ton about him. You know, I'm not as well versed as I probably should be in John Waters. So why don't you kick us off with a little introduction to what you love about John Waters and who he is to you.
Okay, well, John Waters is a Baltimore-based filmmaker and writer, film historian. Mm-hmm. He's kind of a jack of all trades, and he's probably best known for a series of three films he made in the early to mid-70s known as his Trash Trilogy, which is Pink Flamingos, Female Trouble, and Desperate Living. But he also he kind of experienced this like very unexpected explosion of success with his movie Hairspray, which has since been turned into a very successful Broadway musical, and then a film based on the Broadway musical, and who knows, it might become an ice show and whatever else. I mean, I think
it probably will. I wouldn't be surprised. It's a huge cultural touchstone.
Yeah. So
John Waters, obviously a guy who comes out of, you know, loving film and just kind of immersing himself. I think he, if I remember reading or actually, you know, I think I heard it on another podcast, because a podcast I really like called The Last Horror Podcast by Christopher Brown. He I got into him because he did a really, really great Video Nasties podcast a few years back.
Oh, nice.
And he did an episode, even though it's a horror podcast, it's more of a horror and exploitation podcast, and he did an episode on John Waters because he's like, I love his explanation. He's like, well, he's not horror, but I love him, and this is my podcast, so I'm going to talk about him. So he talked about him, and one of the things he said is that John Waters went to NYU and then, like, says that he was there for, like, 5 minutes because he, like, I think he got caught smoking weed in the dorm and got kicked out, and then he just moved home.
Yeah, he was expelled from NYU for pot, and I think that was the first major drug scandal that the school had.
That's kind of hilarious because nowadays we think of pot as like nothing. I mean, before we started the podcast, you know, it was like, you know, we were just chit-chatting about how it's legalized and decriminalized all over, you know, and you know, this would have been what, in the 60s?
Yeah, I think it was around 1967.
Yeah, it's obviously a different world.
No,
totally.
Yeah, I mean, and that's something that I love, because I've had a little bit more experience with than Justin with his films. I mean, when I was a kid, well, the first thing I started getting like my exposure to was the fact that Hairspray and Crybaby played on Comedy Central all the time at like odd hours. So I remember just taking that in, and it's amazing to see, like, you know, the way that it was dealing with race and body image and all these great things. And so once I got a little bit older, figured out who he was, I remember my brother and I just hitting up Hollywood Video at the time and just renting everything and just sitting, you know, for like 2 days and just watching, you know, going. I think at the time we could get a hold of like Pink Flamingos on, except for Desperate Living, which we didn't get to until later when that finally got re-released. But, I mean, just going through those, I mean, it was just so much fun, and it was also a great way to kind of figure out other things to find during that era, you know, moving on to the movies from, like, you know, by Nick Zedd and kind of that strange mm-hmm. little, like, that weird pocket of this, like, kind of punk rock filmmaking, those kind of post-hippiedom, but kind of proto-punk, and all that fun, and just movies that seem to just kind of be the same thing over and over again, but just trying to outdo the last. And then even getting into the, like, I always think of, like, his more suburban films, the, you know, stuff like Polyester and seeing Tab Hunter interact with Divine, and even moving on to Cecil B. DeMented, which, when that movie came out, I was in that age range working at a movie theater, and I was like, just like, fuck yes, this is exactly us, you know, like, I mean, you know, because it's like that age where, like, you're pretentious and excited, and it was great to see a guy, you know, then and now. I mean, when I was then, I thought he was, like, so old, but it was like, oh man, he, like, gets it. He gets what it's like being a 17-year-old who thinks he's, like, way fucking smart about movies and shit, even though I didn't know anything. I've had an awesome relationship with that, and also a big fan of his books. About 3 years ago, downloaded the book on tape of Carsick, and it could have been maybe my favorite thing of that entire year. Just driving around, having John Waters, you know, tell me stories for like 7 hours. So,
yeah, that's such a great book, and I mean, I love the whole story with him and the Corvette kid.
Yes,
the unlikely friendship they formed, but just going back to what you said about how his films had a lot of sharp social commentary. That's one of the things that I really like about his movies, and that I think he doesn't get as much recognition for as he should, which is that his movies are very subversive because they take that social commentary, but, like, he couches it in humor so that when you're watching it, you don't even pick up on it at first. It's only after you see the movie for the first time and you start reflecting on it that you think, like, oh wow, he was actually saying some pretty important things with this.
Oh wow, absolutely. And I love the exaggeration that comes with it too, where he, like, balloons these, like, real things into, like, giant comedy set pieces, like in Polyester with the son who's huffing glue the entire time, but it's like he's the, like, the ultimate, like, you know, bad boy, you know,
everything. Yeah, he's stomping on feet.
Exactly. Yeah. I love that, like, huge, like, everything is so huge, but still focusing on particular aspects of society that are important and that kind of, you know, could be lost on people and just be, you know, looked at as just, you know, like, you know, trash and all the stuff that he kind of plays up with.
Exactly.
He's, like you said, he's way more poignant, and I think a lot of people think about the notoriety more than you think of, like, how clever and progressive a lot of these movies are.
Totally agree.
So, let me just run this down, his filmography, a little bit, and see, you know, your guys are probably going to have said you've seen everything, so I'll just start with the full-length movies. I won't start with his shorts, but if you've seen those, feel free to tell me a little bit about them as we get there. But when he got into, I guess, full-length movies, it started with Mondo Trasho, I believe.
Yeah.
And so Mondo Trasho, then there's a film called The Diane Linkletter Story. I don't know anything about that. That's a short. Okay, that's a short film.
Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, you had something to say?
Yeah, I mean, and Adriana, correct me if I'm wrong. That's the film they basically took the story almost immediately, like while the story was happening, and shot a film and basically had it on the marquee showing at a coffee shop by the time even anyone was getting any of the real details of what had actually happened to Diane Linklater. Am I getting the story correct on that?
Yeah, that's right.
So, I mean, that's an amazing
thing. So Diane Linklater, she committed suicide, right?
Correct, and they pinned it on drugs, so they made their own.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, yeah, they pinned it on drugs, but then later it came out that they knew that, I think it was LSD that they said caused her to commit suicide, but later it came out that they knew that was BS, and they sort of just cooked up that excuse to, I think, further the anti-drug agenda, like the war on drugs.
Mm. Interesting. That's not surprising at all, but yeah, it makes sense. But that was so Mondo Trasho, then another short film, Diane Linkletter Story, and then we have Multiple Maniacs, and then we get into the Trash trilogy that you talked about, Pink Flamingos, Female Trouble, Desperate Living, Polyester, something called Reckless Eyeballs, that's a short, I believe. Yeah, and then Hairspray, Crybaby, Serial Mom, Pecker, Cecil B. Demented, and his final film as a writer-director was A Dirty Shame.
With Johnny Knoxville.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I believe that one, I believe he couldn't get that one below an NC-17 when it released.
Yes.
Yes, we kept trying to get the R rating because they wanted it to show further, but I guess he just wasn't willing to cut enough to get it there. So, this movie that I just listed, as well as, I guess, the other shorts, Eat Your Makeup, Roman Candles, Hag in a Leather Jacket, have you guys seen all or most of those?
I've seen all of his feature-length films, but most of those shorts have not been shown since they debuted. I believe a couple of years ago, there was a retrospective of his films in New York City, and I think they screened at MoMA or some other museum, and unfortunately I missed that. But I did go see an art exhibition that he did that was that coincided with the film retrospective, and that was cool.
It says here that in one of his he did a traveling photography show and showed Hag in a Black Leather Jacket, but it says the rest looks like most of the rest of his shorts kind of have been yet unreleased.
I don't think he likes them.
It doesn't seem like he does.
No. Yeah, because I actually got a chance to see him speak, and he actually talked about a lot of those movies that he doesn't really want to show them. He doesn't really see the value. I guess the people like us who are fans, you know, we want to see it all. We want to see kind of, you know, the progression. But yeah, he has seemed very very quiet about those movies and doesn't really see the value. But yeah, I mean, just to kind of piggyback off what Adriana said, like, yeah, I mean I've seen all of his features. In finally got a chance to see Mondo Trash Show a few years ago, and that was, you know, it was a lot of fun. It was kind of, you know, seeing the direction he's moving in. And I mean, really, with all that you name, I mean, those, in my opinion, those are all bangers. I mean, even A Dirty Shame, which is not really it's definitely, I think, my least favorite, you know, upon rewatch and everything like that.
Same here.
Yeah, but it was still great because it was, once again, we were, you know, being able to see, you know, his film in a theater. So, I mean, that was a huge thing for me going out and seeing a John Waters movie on the big screen and being able to enjoy it. But, I mean, out of all of them, Desperate Living is still probably my favorite, even though it's one of the last of his films that I saw. It definitely always stuck with me. Maybe because it's just so gross and I just always remember all the nastiness and all the Mortville stuff. And you can definitely see, as much as Lloyd Kaufman won't talk about it, a lot of what you see in later Troma is like straight up just stolen from that movie. And as anyone who listens knows that I'm a huge Troma fan. And yeah, when like Citizen Toxie came out, it was basically Desperate Living with Toxic Avenger characters. But yeah, that's one of the ones that really sticks with me. It's so fucking gross.
It is a very visceral, nasty film.
Oh, absolutely. When she's doing her own gender reassignment and everything.
It's my God, that scene.
Yeah, it's so... I mean...
It's obviously fake, but there's still something so gross about it. Like, it just hits you.
Oh yeah, because everything is so dirty and gross already in the movie that like all the and we look at like all the trash is real, all the dirt is real. Why isn't this real? I guess it kind of, at least for me, it like kind of tricks my mind when I'm watching it into thinking. But I remember when I showed that to a group of friends that I really I may have not prepped everybody on like a little like. And I was like, oh, man, it's great. It's from the director of Crybaby. And everyone's like, oh, great. I love Crybaby. And my wife at the time was like, Blaine, you might want to give everyone a heads up since it was like her family members and everything. And things went awful. but it's great. It's, you know, just if you do throw a party at your house and show it to everyone, give them a heads up.
Sound advice.
Let me ask a question. Just something I'm curious about is... So I have not seen Desperate Living. I plan to. I just haven't gotten there. But that said, Divine's not in that film, right?
Correct.
That's correct.
That's an interesting thing to me. I feel like Divine was in, like, I mean, pretty much everything from, what, Multiple Maniacs on for a while. And then, actually, yo, he was in Mondo Trasho, too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's an interesting situation. I'm just curious if you know why.
Well, Divine was starring in an off-Broadway play at the time. I can't remember which play it was, but there was a scheduling conflict that basically meant that Divine could not film Desperate Living, which turned out kind of to be a blessing because that movie is such a fantastic star vehicle for Minx Dole.
Okay. And
I mean, she is so great.
It would have been probably a Divine film. As old as we are, that Divine's in, because if Divine's in a film, it's kind of a Divine film. Except for maybe Hairspray, because, you know, kind of, I guess that's where, well, actually, from that point forward, I guess that was her last, or his. I keep forgetting, am I supposed to refer to Divine as a male or a female? I never know.
You, male. A lot of people would say her, but John Waters always says, I'm sorry, John Waters always uses male pronouns when referring to Divine, because Divine did not identify as a woman. Divine was a man who often portrayed women in film.
Right, and because Divine, I heard John Waters talk about Divine as Harris, too.
Harris Glenn Milstead, yeah.
So I know he's talked about Divine in with the male name, too. So I just wasn't sure, so I don't want to be wrong. So I'll say he, because it's that's the preferred, you know. But but Divine, you know, I guess up until Hairspray, I feel like every one of his films that he's in that I've seen, it's kind of his show. Like, he just eats scenery.
If Divine is going to be in a movie, Divine wants to be the star of the movie. And John Waters once joked that he wished, like, in the remake of Hairspray, Divine would have wanted to play the part of Tracy Turnblad. Yeah.
That's great.
Did Blaine drop out of this call?
No, I'm right here. I was letting you guys talk.
Oh, okay. All right,
cool.
He
just got quiet, which is, you know, that's okay. You know.
No, I was letting you guys work your way through pronouns, because I just take cues from everyone around me.
That's fair. So since I'm the novice compared to y'all, I've seen Multiple Maniacs. I actually reviewed the Criterion for Synapse, I basically wrote a review where I said, man, this Blu-ray is awesome, but not because of the movie. The movie kind of sucks, but every one of the features is cool. And like, listening to the commentary track, which I'm not a big commentary listener all the time, I loved it because it was basically John Waters just telling stories and stuff about, like, you know, the Dreamland crew, and that was really cool. But the movie doesn't do anything for me. Pink Flamingos, I just watched this week, even though we're not technically covering that film. I felt like I should see it. I don't think I've seen the full film for this week. And, I'm, to be honest, I'm not sure I'm going to.
man, you are in
Female Trouble, which we're getting into. I just saw it for the first time this past week, and I have not seen For Living. I've never seen Polyester either, but I think I've seen everything from Hairspray up till Cecil B. Demented, but I don't think I saw that or Dirty Shame. In Hairspray, Crybaby, Serial Mom Pecker. So I'm kind of like, I guess I've seen about half of his films, and I would like to see them all, but some of them I probably will only watch once. I think I had said to you guys that I'm not quite sure why, but having watched Multiple Maniacs, Pink Flamingos, and Female Trouble, even though they're wildly different plots, I feel like I'm just watching the same movie over and over. And I guess it's the aesthetic.
Yeah, I think it's an aesthetic thing and a stylistic thing. Like, there are certain characteristics that all of those movies have in common.
Right. And you obviously, know, Divine being one of them, like I said, is such a key... You know, Divine's character is... Divine's character. I mean, like, it's differences, but it's still Divine. Like, so I think that that's a huge part of why.
Yeah, and I think he's someone like I know we had discussed this off the air, but kind of reminds me a lot of Terry Gilliam, where it's like there's a great idea in there, and each film is almost like it's trying to perfect that off the last movie, and even revisiting, which we'll get into soon, even like revisiting a lot of these ideas years and years after, and still kind of playing with them, which I think is an interesting way, especially when you have someone who's an actual like auteur who's, you know, he's crafting each and every aspect of the movie. I mean, it makes sense to keep trying to perfect things that you've done before. And I also think with bringing back, you know, a lot of the people from Dreamland and, you know, having these reoccurring casts, it's kind of fun to watch them return in the return either as characters or mixing up the roles with different actors and kind of seeing how that plays. I kind of like that for some reason with these movies. I know it's a John Waters movie, you know, 3 minutes into it. I see what you're saying, but you know, it's one of those things. Either you can kind of appreciate it, or get a little sick of that story, you know, on the flip side.
Well, I actually feel like I appreciate it and get sick of it, if that makes sense. Because I don't necessarily know that I want to revisit that era of his films much, but at the same time, like, I really appreciate what he's doing, at least as far as my interpretation of what he's doing, but I don't necessarily know that I always like it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I mean, I think, oh, I'm sorry, I interrupted somebody.
No, we just, yeah, keep going.
You have to interrupt Blaine and I, we don't shut up.
It's okay. Well, I was just gonna say that I disagree with your take on the movies that they're bad, but as a John Waters fan, like, I understand that especially his early films are kind of an acquired taste. So I can't really fault you for feeling that way. But for me, like, I love the sort of bizarro Baltimore of abject sleaze and garishness that he conjures with these early movies. And, you know, to me, sort of the crude and primitive technical and production aspects of his early films, along with like the very hyperbolic dialogue and histrionics, like, really helped cultivate this low rent aesthetic that I find really appealing. And if his movies actually looked good instead of cheap and an obvious product of inexperience, I don't think they would be as effective or surreal as they are. I mean, it truly feels like they exist within a shared universe that is completely removed from any sense of realism or the familiar, and it has an immediacy and authenticity I really like.
Oh, absolutely, and it also seems like a movie that, like, films that can't be recreated. There's just,
right.
Yeah, you couldn't if you tried, because there is so much, like you're saying, you know, just inexperience. I mean, just like a lot of fuckery that's going into it, to where it's like you couldn't put it in a lab and break it down and try to recreate the energy and everything that makes it what it is. Like you said, with the low rent side of it, it only seems natural. It would seem almost like foreign or fake if there was, like, if they, like, really were, like, you know, creating grand sets instead of just throwing a bunch of trash in their parents' backyard. You know what I mean? I love that. But, I mean, moving on, I know we've been kind of dancing around it, but why don't we get started with talking about Female Trouble, which was the film that Adriana brought to us. And, I mean, Adriana, we've been kind of dancing around. I mean, do you want to kind of give everyone a general idea about the story and kind of why you picked it?
All right. Well, first of all, just to piggyback off of a comment you made earlier about Waters sort of revisiting and refining concepts in his filmography, Female Trouble was Waters' early attempt at crime satire, sort of a comment on the way crime is glamorized by both the media and the general public. And it's a concept he revisited much more sharply and effectively later with Serial Mom. But nevertheless, Female Trouble is, I think, a pretty clever examination of what the singer Morrissey once referred to as the romance of crime and being famous for the right reasons versus being famous for the wrong reasons, and how that distinction makes very little difference for some people. And so Female Trouble is, I think, the best of the early Waters films. It's a very wickedly funny and anchored by a tour de force performance from Divine. And it's interesting to me for a few reasons, but one of them is that it's the only Waters film that takes place over the span of a character's entire life, from adolescence to premature death by electric chair. His other films kind of take place during a fixed period of time, so this movie is a little more adventurous. So Female Trouble, it opens with a troubled young woman named Dawn Davenport, played by Divine, and she's kind of a spoiled brat and a troublemaker at school. She runs with a girl gang and talks back to teachers and so forth, and generally feels very put upon and unappreciated. And so one day, she runs away from home when she doesn't get this pair of cha-cha heels that she wants for Christmas in the movie's most infamous scene. And she winds up getting raped, which results in the eventual birth of her daughter, Taffy, who is played by Minx Stoll once she gets a little bit older. And so Dawn feels kind of inconvenienced by motherhood and is existentially adrift until she gets seduced into a life of glamour and crime by these characters, Donald and Donna Dasher, who are this PR Svengali and his fashionista wife. They're played by David Lockery and Marion Vivian Pierce, who are Dreamland regulars. So they exploit Dawn and kind of convince her to do all sorts of ghastly things, including disfiguring herself, until eventually she goes ballistic and murders her kid and a whole bunch of other people, and she is sentenced to death, and the film concludes. And there's also this ridiculous subplot that involves Dawn marrying this guy whose aunt is obsessed with the idea that he's gay, which is a very John Waters subplot. And it's a clever inversion of the attitude that parents sometimes have when their kids come out to them as gay.
When it's like he came out as straight, like mom's so upset that he's a straight man. Yeah, I find that whole subplot very interesting and extremely entertaining. I think that's wonderfully subversive. I think that's a large one of the greatest examples of why I say I appreciate these films that I've seen so far in his early career a lot. Like, I really like the version a lot.
Oh yeah, and that, because that's probably, like, I'm with you, that's one of my favorite just little parts to the whole movie is just listening to Gator go back and forth with Edith Massey trying to explain, like, because I love that he's, like, adamantly he's not homophobic. He's like, I'm just not gay. It's like, and just that playing back and forth. And back in a less enlightened time, I always knew that part from the beginning of the Sloppy Seconds song, I Don't Want to Be a Homosexual. And they always played that whole section. So I remember when I got
older. Can I pause just to tell you that I'm upset that you said it was Sloppy Seconds? It's a Screeching Weasel song.
Okay. No.
The original Weasel is by Screeching Weasel.
No, Screeching Weasel did I Want to Be a Homosexual. Sloppy Seconds said,
I don't want to be. Oh, well, fuck Sloppy Seconds. They were the dickheads. Never mind.
Well, they were the dickheads who also made some fantastic records. But but they always used that whole opening in there. And I was so excited when I finally, like, you know, saw the movie that it went with. And but I mean, yeah, it's definitely like you had mentioned before, Adriana, that it is definitely the best out of those early films. And it also has my favorite Dreamland player in I think his best role with David Lockery right before he passed. And I just think that he is just so good and plays like that gauche, artist type so well. And it's amazing, you know, in just the lunacy of, you know, the drug frenzy with having them, you know, mainline eyeliner and and just running with that, like, that idea of, like, you know, as crime as art and, you know, crime as beauty sort of idea to just, like, the nth degree. And it just, by the end, it culminates in this just this chaos of murder, mayhem, and also Hare Krishna. And I don't know. It's just, it makes me so happy by the end just watching Divine scream, and I blew Richard Speck, you know, like that whole, like just chaos and wild idea. And I love when the crowd is all loving, like, the gawking until, you know, they get killed. It's just so much fun to watch.
I totally agree. And yeah, David Lockery is pitch perfect in this movie. And it's like, he delivers some extremely ridiculous dialogue, and it's like, he doesn't even think twice about it. It's like, he's totally convicted.
Oh yeah. And that's what he was like in all those movies. I always thought that out of that whole group, if he would have lived long enough, to keep acting, I think he could have transitioned into doing at least more kind of cult film kind of work.
Yeah.
Cause he's one out of that whole group that I think he helps elevate and kind of delivers the what's on the page that that John Waters writes so well. He's one of the few that can really deliver it in a way that just, you know, I mean, and I'm not knocking a lot of the regulars like Mink Stoll, who's fantastic, Edith Massey, who is just irreplaceable in these roles, but I just think that he's just had that something where he could just, you know, really feel naturalistic with things that were just, I mean, most of his lines are kind of just gibberish, but he plays it so aloof and so, yeah, I don't know, in that fantastic mustache that, you know, goes throughout his face, just great. I he's just one of those guys I'm always bummed out when I realize, like, how young he passed, and you know, that we only have these, you know, three films that he did, you know. But yeah, so but lots of great performances. I mean, Justin, with this being your first time seeing the film, I mean, what were some of your favorite performances in the movie?
I really like Lockery a lot. I think both. I told you, you know, I've seen the three films that you're referring to, of that Lockery's in, because, you know, with Pink Flamingos and Multiple Maniacs, and I actually like him in all three quite a bit. And in this film, he was maybe, yeah, listen, the dialogue he delivers in this film, there were times where I just jotted down things he said, like, I got to remember this. This is fucking ridiculous. But you're right. He delivers it like it's no big deal. Like, it's just legit, you know? And I really, really appreciate that about him a lot. Side note on the podcast that I was mentioning before, that I heard them talking about, you know, Waters, I think that's where I heard this, Divine, I guess, said that he didn't even know what a drag queen was before he met David Lockery. So that's kind of,
yeah.
I guess they were kind of inseparable buds. So it's really sad, you know, he died so young. And I can't help but think, I was thinking that too. And I was thinking about how I would have loved to see him, like, grow as an actor and maybe really where he'd fit into the later films of Waters, because I think he could have been pretty phenomenal in some of them. So it is really just sad. But outside of him, you know, I really like the quirkiness of all the Dreamlanders. From what I can tell, like, they look like they're having a freaking blast. And they're like a big family being ridiculous on film and trying to prove a specific point, but also not really, just trying to have fun too. And, like, there's something about their charisma as a whole. And so I think that's a large part, again, of why I said, you know, I appreciate what they're doing, because they just seem like they're having a good time, and they're doing something different, and they're putting a big middle finger in the face of, you know, anyone who wants to poo-poo what they're doing, you know? And I really appreciate that. And that's, you know, you brought up a punk band, you know, and I
wrongly argued because, you know, I love Screeching Weasels. I want to be a homosexual, but I love that song. But that said, that's a very punk rock attitude, you know, the fuck you if you don't like what we're doing. And being born and bred on punk rock, you know, I'm so for that.
Yeah, and in fact, Divine's look towards the end of Female Trouble was very proto-punk with the mohawk and everything.
Definitely. Very, very punk rock. Yeah, yeah, I agree. Especially that the era this film came out of was that proto-punk era, and Maryland had, Baltimore area had some really interesting musical things going on in the time, too. So I definitely made that connection as well.
Yeah, and let's not forget that end sequence where she has the mohawk and everything, that has given so much life to so many balding, overweight 40-year-old drag queens for you know, decades now. So yeah, let's not overlook that little gift that Divine gave.
Divine was drag anarchy. Divine proved that there was no rule book for drag. Like, you just create your look, own it, go out and do whatever you want to.
Right, and I'm sure there's a lot of people that were already on, like, that entire idea of it being more of a performance art than more like a sexual proclivity. You know what I mean? And I think that when you see her roles in there, it really at least kind of normalizes that idea in a time where it probably was more looked at as more of a sexual perversion rather than performance art and a way of being able to kind of dress yourself into a role. So yeah, I mean, we could probably do a whole another episode on just Divine. So I'm sorry for sidetracking there.
No,
that's okay.
That's awesome. Yeah. Well, and I think you can't have John Waters' discussion without talking about Divine. You just can't. There's definitely an attachment between the two, and they both, I think, there would be no Divine as we know Divine without Waters, and there probably wouldn't be a Waters without a Divine either in a lot of ways, I think. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's kind of what I take from it.
I think they had like a, I don't know if symbiotic is the right word, but they definitely like egged each other on and supported each other and empowered each other to be creative and to make these movies. So in a sense, I agree. Like, I'm not really sure where Waters would be right now if he hadn't met Divine, you know, if they didn't just happen to have lived on the same street and he didn't start hanging out. And
I don't want to glaze over the fact that Divine rapes Divine.
Right.
In this movie, that's some great camera magic.
Yeah, that Divine, the man who raped Divine is actually Harris himself. So that is a really, really, I'm double taking as I'm watching this scene going, wait, hold up, that looks just like Divine, but not without the makeup. And then when they're on the phone later, yelling at each other, I'm like, holy shit, wait, that's totally, and then I looked it up and I'm like, yep, it is. Wow. And, you know, and then I found there was like a body double for the rape, but still the rest of it, it's pretty freaking impressive to do to do the camera magic of Divine raping Divine. It was very interesting.
The Christmas morning rape.
Right, the Christmas morning rape. That's another good point.
Yeah, because I mean, I know you had touched on it, Adrian, but like let's not also, I know I talked about how crazy the end of it is, but that beginning, like that after the cha-cha, you know, the famous, you know, cha-cha heel scene, how insane that goes from. It's like Christmas morning, stomps outside, gets raped by the first person, has a baby, turns the crime. Like, I love, like, just this whole, like, the most extreme version of these, like, teenage, you know, teenage delinquent films. Just amped up. It's like,
and don't forget the mother being crushed under the Christmas tree.
Oh, shit. Oh, I almost forgot about that.
And the dad's so concerned with reprimanding and fighting Divine that he doesn't even save his wife. He's just laying there.
Yeah, and you just hear...
Oh, my God, that scene is so bizarre. I love it.
You hear, like, this ADR, not on Christmas.
like it'd be better on any other day, but
yeah, that scene was inspired by something that actually happened.
Oh my God.
A Christmas tree fell on, I think it was John Waters' grandmother. But yeah, so that he took inspiration from real life for that scene.
That's crazy. All right, so fast forward from, you know, the early to mid 70s to 98.
Yeah.
With the release of Pecker, which is my selection. I picked Pecker because Pecker is my favorite John Waters film.
That's interesting to me.
Yeah, I love that film. I believe I actually, the first film of his I saw would probably have been Hairspray. And then Pecker definitely the second. I probably saw Pecker before I saw Serial Mom, because I didn't see Serial Mom till college. But to put that out there is I love the I'll be honest with. Got me to rent Pecker is the fact that I was obsessed with Christina Ricci. Have been ever since, like, Casper and her Wednesday Addams, of course. And so I, you know, grew up loving everything she did. Still love her a lot. And she was, you know, she was one of my favorite actresses for a long time. And so that's what got me into checking the movie out. But what made the movie something I replayed for years and years and have on I have a DVD, I've actually have a Blu-ray, and I actually have it digitally, so I own that movie in three different ways, which is rare for me because I don't really do a lot of physical media. I do a lot of streaming these days, but it's just a lot of fun. So for those not familiar with the movie, the short version of it is there's this kid named Pecker from Baltimore, of course, and he likes to take pictures with an old beat ass camera, and they're of, you know, just the stuff going around around him, the stuff that's going on around him. And then he gets discovered, and douchey New Yorkers decide they want to kind of hijack his art. And it, without trying to root, I don't know what else to say. It's just that he decides, no, you know what, I'm staying here in Baltimore. They can come to me. And that's kind of the big climax of the film. And it's really just all the crazy stuff that's going on around him that he, and how it all kind of is caught through his voyeuristic, you know, lens. And it's really about, you know, the people in his life and the things going on. And it's very much a character piece. So I love it. I just love the film.
Well, Pecker, what do you guys think? After A Dirty Shame, Pecker is the Waters film that I probably revisit the least.
Okay.
And I don't hate it. But it just never really resonated with me on the level of a lot of his other movies. But there are things that I really like about it. And what you touched on about it being very character-driven, I really like that about it. And I think it's an interesting examination of how fame doesn't just impact the person who
right.
is, you know, the object of scrutiny,
right, so like,
but it also disrupts the life. It disrupts the life of everybody around him. You know, his friend can't shoplift anymore. His eccentric grandmother is ridiculed by the public, so the everyday lives of his family and friends are completely upended, and he has to kind of reckon with that.
Definitely.
Yeah, and I have incredibly similar feelings as Adriana does. This is definitely one of the ones I always kind of think of as lesser, and I kind of forget about it, but once I do start watching it, I do enjoy kind of the sweetness of it. It's a very cute movie in my opinion. Like,
yeah.
Kind of like it's like when I said before, revisiting ideas. It's almost like taking that female trouble and cuting it up, and you know, kind of putting this Edward Furlong in this kind of aw shucks sort of role with, you know, of course, you know, his you know kind of crazy you know, girlfriend, you know, the stain goddess, and it's all very cute. I think that there are a lot of things that John Waters does right and kind of he gets a chance to give a sincere kind of framing of what he loves about Baltimore and the people in it. But I don't know, it kind of plays out just, I don't know, maybe it's just that little bit of sweetness, but I mean, I remember the thing that still sticks with me the most is I had some weird crush on Patty Hearst growing up. Like just reading like stories, I remember like a history class learning about Patty Hearst, and I thought, oh my gosh, she's so cute. Then like seeing her in this movie and that being like a big deal to my very you know, teenage mind, especially when they take the picture of her adjusting herself, weird things. I'm stop talking about it, Mom. But but no, I mean, but there was that cuteness. But and I mean, to me, my favorite character in the whole movie is the little sister. Who, you know, is every time you're seeing her, she's shoving, you know, just sucking down sugar and candy. And then it's so,
oh my
sad.
God.
It's so sad when she goes on Ritalin and she's just this, like, drooling zombie. And so, but I mean, like, I see why you like it. And with doing the show with you for a while, Justin, I can definitely see where it kind of plays to things that you like, definitely. I won't ever say it's a bad movie. It's just lesser, and then I think I'm always expecting still a few more punches in there outside of just, you know, throwing her, you know, the teabagging and stuff, because even that is like cute. It's like, oh,
it is. But I think that what I love about this film, when I really like rewatching it now that I've gotten more into a lot of exploitation and stuff than I ever was, obviously. Me, you know, in 1998, you know, I was watching all Hollywood films primarily, you know, and this is probably one of his most Hollywood-type films, you know what I mean? But that's totally probably why it sucked me in at first. But at the same time, for something that's very palatable for quote-unquote normal people, it still finds a way to be subversive. And I think that's what I like about it, because it's like, it's something that I have. I can't even say I could watch with my mother. I have watched this with my mother. And my mom doesn't watch films like your mom does, Blaine. You know, my mom doesn't watch, the Zodiac Killer with me, you know, 1970s batshit crazy weird stuff, you know. My mom watches, you know, Dancing with the Stars, and then I throw a movie on afterwards, you know, because I need to clean my palate. But that said, right, it's very much like, it's something that I can watch in a kind of, I mean, it's not quite a family film. I'm not going to show my kid, you know, a movie where a guy's taking pictures of naked vaginas. But, that said, it's not really the vagina, it's the hair, which is a whole big thing, right? The pubic hair. There's a lot of talk about pubic hair in this movie. But that's kind of my point, is that stuff, you know, it's like a palatable movie for normal people that deals with stuff that shouldn't really be that palatable. And I think that's awesome. I think it's really cool that he can make a movie that kind of bridges that gap. And I think that's why I fell for it. Now, that said, I say it's my favorite of his films. In revisiting some of his other films, I could find myself maybe veering more towards Serial Mom and or Hairspray with a few more watches as well, where those to me might be stronger films on the whole. But this film, probably because it's the one that really made me start to open my eyes a little bit more to who he is and what he's about, it's definitely one I really love.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, no, I mean, I can totally see that, Justin. I mean, like, because I think I might be, and I'll be first to admit it. When you mention all this stuff, I guess I kind of downplay that there is still shocking stuff in, like, that.
Right.
I guess when you go back to back with, you know, watching Female Trouble,
you watch Female Trouble and Pecker back to back.
I agree, because I went back. I mean, if you look at like Roger Ebert's review, like he even mentions like there should have been a bigger punch somewhere in there to like for me when I walked away to remember, from those scenes, because there are some set pieces that could go too far. But I mean, not gonna knock a guy, but what we mentioned before in music, I think this film has got such a fantastic soundtrack.
Correct.
And you go with all the Ray Stevens, and you've got, of course, Woohoo by the Rocketeens. You got a lot of like fun music, and you can see most of that $6 million budget. God, I mean, had it been about $2 million just put in to, right, to music in itself and licensing.
Right, I agree. You're right. I'm sure he probably spent a lot of it on the licensing, but I do get how if you're deeper into his filmography, it comes off as far less of a gut punch. But I think that the thing is, if you think about the people that this film can reach, it's a huge gut punch for some of them. So that, I guess that's, again, that's why I think I appreciate it a lot. But you're right. I mean, when I think about it, it does seem to lack maybe like a the one part of the film I don't love is I like the way it ends until I don't. Like, I like the whole ending, but I feel like there needs to be like something more, and maybe that gut punch that you're talking about is that something more that it was missing for me. I don't know, but
you think it wraps up too neatly?
Yeah, it does. It does. It definitely wraps up a little too neatly. I think that's exactly it. Especially when you look at the rest of his films. You know, a lot of them don't wrap up so neatly.
Right.
That's such an understatement. Because we just talked about Female Trouble. And, a little bit less neat in how it wraps up. But I basically said that Pecker's probably my favorite film but I think that, you know, with some more examination, I think along my taste, it would probably become Serial Mom or Hairspray, because I love both of them a lot as well. That said, what would you guys say are your favorite Waters films? Adriana, is Female Trouble the one that's your favorite? Is that why you chose it? Or are there others that you would say you like more?
Well, Female Trouble is my favorite of the early Waters films, and Serial Mom is my favorite latter-day Waters, and I think Serial Mom is his strongest film overall. But I chose Female Trouble just because I think it's a really fun movie. It's really over the top and nutty, and the plot is so absurd, and it's, I think, probably his most quotable film. And it's a movie that I can watch over and over and over again and laugh at all of the same parts, and it never loses its edge or its humor. So that's why I chose Serial Mom.
Yeah, and I mean, my favorite film, like I said before, is Desperate Living, just because of I think a lot of it has to do with the shock, but also being able to kind of refine more what I like about it after our discussion is maybe that lack of Divine kind of lets it be more of its own thing. Overall, and kind of a cool, bridging of the gap. But I mean, I love Polyester. I think it's a really fun kind of take on that like 50s and 60s TV family sort of idea of kind of a Leave It to Beaver and in Hell sort of thing.
Leave It to Beaver in Hell.
Or like women's pictures.
Yeah, like a women's good. Very, thank you. That defines it way better. I like those two so much, and I mean, but also like I mean, if I'm gonna go to Serial Mom, has to be up there. I love that. I love the Pussy Willows gag. It always makes me laugh so hard, and just watching her get all excited when they're watching Blood Feast, and that movie, it also kind of shows a lot of kind of. He gets a chance to kind of put forward a lot of his influences, which is really fun to see, because who else, I remember at the time, I mean, I never expected anyone else to say like, I love Herschel Gordon Lewis. Because even though I was watching that crap, even I can't say I love Herschel Gordon Lewis. I mean, he made awful movies. He made She-Devil on Wheels, which is great.
And then I love that movie.
Yeah, which is fantastic. But I mean, like, are you going to tell me you're going to sit down and enjoy watching Blood Feast?
I kind of do enjoy watching Blood Feast, and I don't know. I met Herschel Gordon Lewis.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty awesome.
He Exhumed Films in Philly did like an H.G. Lewis Gorathon where they screened five of his films. So, you know, I saw Blood Feast in a packed theater with Herschel Gordon Lewis there, and that was awesome. But I don't know. I find that movie kind of, like, endearing in its ineptitude.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely endearing. It's cool to see Connie Mason look like she's acting, kind of. there's lots of great things in there. And I'm going to go more into Herschel Gordon Lewis once we get into our recommendations. But, like, what I was saying was that it was kind of cool seeing, like, something out of Hollywood that was kind of echoing the things that I was watching at that time. And also with Justin said, watching a movie with your family, Serial Mom, as you know, as blue as some of the humor is, it's still something that you can watch, like, with your folks without, you know, where they're going to be enjoying it just as much as you. I know we're just going on and on about the great stuff about John Waters, but he is probably one of the only kind of directors to be able to make films dealing with such perverse stuff and kind of make it palatable for everybody in those later films. I mean, once you get into his last two, maybe not with Cecil B. DeMented and A Dirty Shame, but in that era, man, who else has ever done something like that when you think about it in that way, outside of, like, maybe David Lynch doing Twin Peaks on television? That's maybe the only two times where you've had such subversive figures make something that was so well received by everybody.
Right, but you know what? Waters' subversion doesn't stop, like you're saying. Like, I love David Lynch, but I don't think he was. I love the Twin Peaks stuff, and I was way into the new Twin Peaks and everything, but I don't know that he's really trying to say a lot. I think he's just trying to fuck with people's minds. Whereas I think John Waters has so much to say. I think that's what I really appreciate about the early stuff. And then you're putting it exactly into words what I'm thinking as far as the way in that, you know, what I guess, I've never seen Polyester, so I don't know if that, where that fits in the scope of things, but from, like, Hairspray through, you know, Pecker, you know, I feel like there's a lot of really interesting subversive stuff going on, but in a palatable, like, normal people can handle it kind of way. And I like when people find a way to tell those who wouldn't watch his early films the same kind of messages that are in his early films. Does that make sense? You know what I mean? Like, I really love that.
No, absolutely. Well, and Adriana, you're about to say something.
Well, first of all, I just want to say that not to go on too much of a tangent, but I disagree that David Lynch doesn't have anything to say. I think he has a great deal to say about the nature of good versus evil and man's capacity to commit heinous acts. But
I don't disagree with you there, but I think he went – well, we'll talk about him another time. We'll bring you back on for him.
Adriana, I want you on all these shows just to actually formulate the shit in my head. So keep telling him he's wrong, please.
No, I think we actually probably agree more than I expressed, but that's another. Again, I'd love to come back, and we'll have you back on for David Lynch if you'd like, because that's a topic that we have to definitely start diving into soon too. So.
Yeah, I'd be down for that, or if you want to do an H.G. Lewis episode.
I'm not sure if I'm ready for an H.G. Lewis episode, because I have to watch H.G. Lewis then, and I'm not sure I really want to.
You're watching a lot of spanking.
So anyway, you were saying.
A lot of spanking, sir.
But so, Adriana, you were saying something before I derailed you.
I don't even really remember what I was going to say, other than John Waters is one of the only things both my mother and I agree on.
That's awesome.
In terms of the kind of media we consume, like, my mom loves John Waters. Like, my mom would want nothing more than to have John Waters over to her house for dinner and to just, like, gossip with him. Yeah. And I think you're right. Like, there aren't very many filmmakers who can make such transgressive work like he has, and also, you know, have moms love him.
Right.
No, absolutely. I mean, and if you think about with, I mean, and you know, let me mansplain from a straight white male's perspective. I know everyone loves that. But I mean, but you think about his, the kind of impact that he has of making like very queer cinema, even, I mean, throughout the entire career, even with these films. I mean, you think about people like, at least in my life, that if you, you know, have just been kind of old fashioned homophobics, like not, but it's almost like he can kind of push that great kind of just in your face queer centric film and package it to the mainstream to where it's like, okay, I could hang out all day with this guy, even though I may have differing opinions or anything like that. Because I mean, we're making, you gotta think, when you're making these films in this era, it's not exactly like now where everybody's like, oh, okay, you know, a lot more free thinking. I mean, just dealing with the concept of homosexuals being portrayed as main characters is, I mean, that's a pretty wild thing when you think about a lot of these films, even with, you know, Polyester, which was basically a vehicle for Tab Hunter to come out of the closet. I mean, I just can't say enough about how he transcends kind of culture in general. There's just very few people. I mean, even now with being just a counterculture figure, he's transcended again. It's like he keeps moving up and up until now he's just kind of this like godfather to everything. You know, I don't know. I just think there's very few artists that stay relevant over the course of, you know, nearly 50 years. I mean, I'm going to cough up $120 in a few months to go see his Christmas special in town. You know what I mean? Like, how many figures can still kind of drive that well into their 70s?
No, definitely. I think that you're dead on there. And I mean, I think we all, even though we have different opinions on which films we gravitate towards and whatever, I think that just shows that you can have vastly differing, you know, tastes in some ways and still find yourself attracted to what he's doing. It's just very magnetic, you know. It's very interesting, and I love people like that, and so again, that's some of our favorite stuff, and I really appreciate talking about all this stuff. Before we kind of start to wrap up here, I had asked both of you guys to think of a recommendation for those listening that's somehow related to John Waters, but not one of the films that he directed. And I'll start with our guest, Adriana. What would you like to recommend to the folks listening to check out?
Well, I have four things here. I won't cover all that. I think Blaine may actually cover some of he alluded to Herschel Gordon Lewis earlier as an influence. But the first thing I have is a documentary called I Am Divine, directed by Jeffrey Schwartz, and it's a really excellent documentary that covers the life of Divine from childhood until his passing in the late 80s. And the thing I really like about it that I think is worth recommending is that it delves pretty deep into the aspects of Divine's career that a lot of people don't know about. For example, his career as a recording artist and his the Cockettes and his work and just a whole lot of stuff that even some pretty big Waters fans have no idea he ever did. And it's also, it's a pretty emotional, heart-rending watch too, because, you know, Divine struggled a lot with depression and weight fluctuation and issues that a lot of people can relate to.
Right.
And then another thing I have is a documentary called The Cockettes, which is about the San Francisco-based sort of like hippie psychedelic performance art drag troupe that Divine was briefly involved with in the early 70s. And that's a trip. And then the last thing I have is a book called Low Budget Hell, Making Underground Movies with John Waters by this guy named Robert Meyer. Meyer worked in some capacity or another on every Waters film from Female Trouble through Crybaby. He was a very close friend of John Waters, and so the book details his experiences with John, both creatively on the sets of John's movies, but also in their day-to-day interactions. And it's a really illuminating read, because besides Waters' book Shock Value, it's definitely the most in-depth and informative resource that is available when it comes to like production details of all these movies, because there isn't a lot of background information available about how these movies got made, you know, besides like interviews with Waters. So you have this firsthand account from somebody who was there every single day on of these movies. Especially Blaine, if you love Desperate Living, definitely check out this book, because he really goes into detail about, the farm where a lot of the exterior Mortville shots was located, and all of like the weird issues they had on set, which I won't go into because they are numerous, but definitely check it out.
No, most definitely. And I am jotting that down right now, because I know that I will love reading that, because yeah, that is awesome.
So Blaine, why don't you jump right into your recommendation?
Yeah, and I've got two recommendations as well. I wanted to do one that was my favorite of his acting roles, as well as a film that I think just really kind of uses that inspiration in a good way. The first one I want to recommend is 2003's sequel to the Herschel Gordon Lewis film, Blood Feast 2, All You Can Eat, directed by, of course, Mr. Herschel Gordon Lewis as well. It basically picks up, about 30 years after the original. You've got the grandson of Fuad Ramsey. He's basically doing the same thing where he's, you know, building this blood feast for Ishtar. It's super zany, really, really sleazy. It's got this great soundtrack by Southern Culture on the skids. And what made me want to bring it up is just how there's this very, very small role by John Waters as playing this priest at the end, but it is so good, and he just gets to ham it up in such a great way. The film itself it didn't really age well with being shot on digital, and it's only kind of had some pretty ugly releases over the years. I need to check out the Arrow that's on that box set, but because I still have a terrible Media Blasters copy that I think Shriek Show put out. But it's a really fun movie. It's got like great energy. It's relatively short, and it's just basically that same kind of like ugly, cheap gore that he's known for, but kind of revved up with like a psychobilly soundtrack and just a bunch of like foxy ladies and tons of really silly set pieces. The other film I wanted to recommend just is something that's like that I think draws inspiration in a really good and positive way is a movie from last year called Dolly Deadly, directed by Miss Heidi Moore, who is a fantastic artist. Really love following her continued career overall. But it's basically about a young boy who I believe is played by her son, who's stuck in this trailer park. He's being raised by his grandmother and her like shitty boyfriend after his mother has a like basically kills herself by in a hair dyeing incident, and eventually he starts taking on this like this character of creating himself as a doll. And starts going on a murdering spree, and it's just this really strange, trashy, like immediately cult film where I don't think you get that very often, where you're watching something knowing like, oh my god, like this is a cult film even though it's brand new. I think she just frames it really well, and it's everybody is loud and disgusting and ugly, and the TV programs that the characters all watch are like these exaggerated like redneck nightmares sort of things, and it ends up getting really, really dark and murderous towards the end, but it still carries this like strange level of pitch black humor that is really fun, because it kind of plays with me too, because like I don't know, I hate watching little kids get picked on, And it's just so refreshing when she finally cuts loose and starts killing everybody off. And she is currently doing a sequel, I believe, through Troma Pictures. That's going to be a musical, and it's going to it's starring, I believe, mostly drag queens, and it's going to fit really well into that because there's also like a huge like musical element. So I believe it's still available to watch on Amazon Prime. So if you get a chance, check out Dolly Deadly. Swing by, with Heidi Moore and show her some love because I think she is one of the real like up and coming low budget directors who's going to continue to put out some pretty great material. And plus, I mean, it's great to be seeing these filmmakers coming up and more female directors being able to get these projects and continuing to push forward. So yeah, just check that out. Like I said, Amazon Prime. And Justin, what did you bring?
So I've been starting to get into some holiday films, specifically some holiday horror with some prep work I've been doing for the upcoming spectacular optical book, Yuletide Terror. And I think that's what it's called, Yuletide Terror. I'm pretty sure. But the point of the story is one of the things I was doing was interviewing a person who wrote a chapter, and one of the chapters they wrote was on Christmas Evil.
And I love that movie.
Nice. Christmas Evil is one of John Waters' favorite movies, and he actually even did a commentary that I have yet to listen to on a DVD release a few years back. So I'm going to pick it because it's one of his favorite films, and because I checked it out when I was going through Video Nasties a few years ago, and I really love it. So it's a really fun horror film.
No, and that's a movie that I came super late to it. I think I watched for the first time.
I did too. I mean, like I said,
a couple years ago. Yeah. So that's a fantastic pick.
Yeah, a lot of fun. I'm starting to, you said you were kind of ready to talk about stuff other than horror. I still find myself gravitating towards a lot of horror, and I'm obsessed with horror these days. And I think it's because it's somehow the most horrific things on screen are still less horrific than what's going on in the world right now. But I really like the Christmas Evil an awful lot. And I've only been watching it now for a few years, but I watch it every holiday season. So I'll recommend that. And with that, just before we sign off, I want to give Adriana an opportunity to tell folks where they can check her out on the internet.
Well, you can find my writing at cinepunks.com. That's CINEPUNX. And you can find me on Twitter at Jeer the Lights, JEERTHELIGHTS. That's a Morrissey reference.
I thought so. I know you're a big Morrissey fan from things that I've read of yours in conversations that I've had online with you. So I was going to ask you, but I had a feeling it was Morrissey related. So I'm not a big Morrissey person. Not that I don't like Morrissey, so please don't jump down my throat at the moment. But I just don't know enough about Morrissey to have picked it up right away. So thanks for explaining that.
You're welcome.
So thank you so much for coming on, Adriana. We definitely will. I guess we have a couple episodes left with you down the road. We're going to have to do ACL and David Lynch with you. So I'm excited to talk those and get yelled at about how I'm wrong, because I probably am. But no, you didn't yell at me, but I am probably wrong a lot. So that's okay. But David Lynch, I will correct. I didn't want to act like he's saying nothing, but
Those are the words you use.
It's okay.
Man.
You're forgiven.
Say that. But you know what? I think I'm still bitter from how much he fucked my mind with the final season of Twin Peaks. Like, I'm still
yeah, recovering. That last episode.
Oh my god! Like,
I'm still recovering.
Like, I just it hurts. Although one other recommendation I'll make before we leave is get the new book. The new Twin Peaks book that came out last week. My wife and I have already read through it. It's a series of dossiers. It's a really fun read. If you're interested in following that whole world,
nerds.
My wife and I are fucking huge nerds on the Twin Peaks stuff. So, but yeah. So thanks a lot, Adriana.
Thank you for having me. I had a really good time.
Awesome. And, you know, living literally that since I live like down the road, there's really no excuse for us to not hang out sometime. So
yeah, we totally should. Yeah, we can go comic book shopping or whatever.
All right. I'd be okay with that. You might have like my two kids tagging along, but, you know, I don't think you'd mind.
No, that's fine.
Awesome. And Blaine, why don't you take us out in your patented Blaine way?
Okay, absolutely. Well, thank you again, Adrian. We had a blast. We'll be hopefully seeing and hearing from you soon. But thank you, everybody, for checking it out. Make sure you like and subscribe and share the shit out of this. Thank you again. Have a good night and peace.
I got lots of problems.
Podcast in 3 days, so welcome back, everybody. This is Blaine, and this what the fuck? You guys are making me laugh. All right.